fusion of knowledge and understanding.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American society has lost its civic voice, says political philosopher Michael Sandel. Communitarian views of liberty, participation, and self-governance, he says, have been abandoned and replaced by America's pursuit of individualism and zeal for personal choice. Michael Sandel has looked closely at the dynamics of democracy with a big D through American history. Today, he looks out over the American landscape and finds an impoverished vision of citizenship being shared by liberals and conservatives alike. This year, America has mounted an ambitious campaign to export democracy. An important presidential election year is now upon us. Tonight on Point, the big picture, we're keelhauling America's very public policy, philosophy that is, dragging it up on the beach for a good look-see. What's your angle on American democracy and its discontents? Beyond Bush, Dean, Sharpton, and all the rest, how are we defining the democratic project these days? What's the goal, and are we headed there? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Michael Sandel, professor of government at Harvard, author of Democracy's Discontent, America in Search of a Public Philosophy, and Liberalism and the Limits of Justice. He tracks the history of political thought, globalization, ethics, democracy, and justice. He is one of America's most quoted and admired political philosophers. We're very glad to have him with us tonight. Good evening and welcome, Michael Sandel.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Michael. Great to have you with us.
Hi, Jack.
Michael Sandel, we're kind of laying down a baseline this evening for the whole election year that is about to burst upon us. The calendar's going to turn over. It's going to be January. There'll be primaries and conventions and balloting and all the rest. We want to take a big step back with you before that does rain down on us, just to look at the whole framework of American democracy right now, how it's doing as we head into this big and important presidential election year, as we're exporting democracy to Iraq. You take it down to a very, very basic level, which you describe as the public philosophy of the country. What is public philosophy? And if you had to define America's public philosophy right now, what would you say? How would you do it?
Well, I think you put it well, Tom, when you posed the question, what is the democratic project today? Because answering that question is one of the first questions of having or aspiring to a public philosophy. And traditionally, the democratic project is about two things. One of them is about forging a common life, about building a sense of community, a sense that of common purposes and deliberation about the common good. And the second part of the democratic project is sharing in self-rule, having some meaningful say in controlling the forces that govern our collective lives. And so any test, it seems to me, of the health of the democratic project has to look both at the sense of community and also at the project of self-government, whether we really do sense that we are helping shape our collective destiny.
Well, we share the landscape and we vote if we like. So Does that mean we're doing fine?
Well, democracy on this more expansive definition isn't only about voting, although people's willingness to turn out to the polls is one measure of the health of democracy. And political participation has been going down for a very long time in the United States, going all the way back to the 60s. Since then, there's been a general decline in people's willingness to vote in elections. But I think that beyond this, there are some I think it has something to do with the terms of the political argument, the way the parties carve up the political landscape and argue about it. And I think the big problem, and we're seeing it too even in this election, is that the questions that the major parties are debating don't seem to be the ones that people care about.
How would you define what they're debating, and how would you define what people want to hear debated?
I think we need to go to the big fact that has in many ways changed the shape of American politics, and that's 9/11. If you look back at the 1990s, there was a kind of agreement between the mainstream participants in both political parties about the inevitability of globalization, about the success of democratic capitalism, American style, mm-hmm. after the Cold War.
Cold War's over. We won. Hallelujah. Let's go.
That's it. And both parties basically accepted that, and were really debating the details of how to work out the consequences of that victory, that triumph mm-hmm. in the Cold War. And so the question then was, well, there was great faith in globalization, in the idea that national borders matter less and less. There was a kind of Washington consensus. We force free markets upon developing countries. A rising tide will lift all boats, free trade, mm-hmm. NAFTA, all of that. And what that overlooked were roiling questions of political identity and community, an uncertainty about modernity and the cultural assumptions of modernity in many parts of the world. And I think after 9/11, the blithe confidence in that project of globalization and the spreading of democratic capitalism, that was called into question. And suddenly the nation has made a comeback. Suddenly the nation...
The nation as an idea, as an entity, as a frame for discussing and seeing the world. We'll get to that global picture, but take it back to the national for a moment here.
Right.
Even in the midst of that kind of blithe certainty, as you say, of the 1990s, in 1996, you were writing, wait a minute, we've got a problem here. We're not really addressing fundamental issues. The public philosophy is sliding off in a direction that may not be nourishing to democracy.
Right.
Take us back to what your concerns were then, in the mid-90s, even in the midst of affluence and this kind of confidence about where the project stood. And in American terms, before we go global, how has that changed post-9/11?
Well, there were two problems then, I think, that were missed by this gloss, this kind of blithe confidence. One of them had to do with the sense that the fabric of community was unraveling, was eroding from families to neighborhoods to schools and congregations mm-hmm. and trade unions mm-hmm. to the nation. Mm-hmm. The ties that hold the society together were unraveling. And so there was a worry about moral authority and excess individualism, some of it captured by those cultural conservatives on the right.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Clinton, in his way, had an ear for this and managed to bring values into the discourse of the Democratic Party. So that was one problem. And the other had to do with the sense that in an age of globalization, when the nation, even the most powerful nation, the United States, wasn't fully the master of its economic destiny, the question arose, can we really, we as citizens, have a meaningful say in self-rule, in our collective destiny? So those were the kind of besetting problems under the surface.
Unraveling of community and uncertainty about whether citizens or even a powerful nation
right.
could have a say in the way it's gone. Have those changed? Did 9/11 change those? Are those still the underlying kind of big streams of concern, of uncertainty as this election dawns on us?
Well, yes and no. The question of community changed a little. You remember after 9/11, there was an outpouring of not only patriotism, but a sense that we are in this together. We've been attacked as a nation for what we represent. Everyone was expressing a sense of solidarity with New York, especially. There was a sense of national pride and solidarity that we hadn't seen for a while.
But was that tantamount to really re-knitting the social fabric, the sense of community and cohesion?
I don't think so, though there was the hope and the expectation on the part of some that
felt good. Felt like the old-time feeling for a while there.
It did, but it was ephemeral. And I think the first moment when the ephemeral character of it became clear is when President Bush spoke about the new war against terrorism, and people asked what they could do as citizens to enlist in this
mm-hmm,
war,
mm-hmm.
And what contribution they could make. And you remember his answer? Go out and shop. Go to the shopping mm-hmm, mall mm-hmm. so that the economy won't suffer. so that people won't be cowering and the economy, the consumer economy.
Which took us back to that old view that you described, kind of atomized citizenry with no real responsibility other than being part of the economic system, but not really a civic role to play.
Yes. And so there, what might have been in a brief moment after 9/11, a moment of a civic energy, kind of fell away back into the individualist, consumer-oriented preoccupations of modern American life.
Jack Beattie, Michael Sandel's got a big, big vision. We've just begun to scratch it here tonight. We're headed into a big election season. We're exporting democracy or trying to Iraq. What's the big question that sits at the forefront of your mind about where the project stands tonight?
Well, you know, listening to Michael talk about the sort of the aspirations of democracy, a deliberative system where we discuss issues, where we come to some kind of reasoned judgment, and self-rule, when I put those rubrics against what we have, it seems to me that, well, the people do not rule, that is just a sort of empirically validated fact. We know that's not. We know we don't rule. Money rules. Campaign contributions rule. Look at the legislation that just passed in the last Congress for that. And as for deliberation, increasingly, truth itself is becoming an aspect of our pluralism. I mean, it used to be, you know, pluralism was about religious beliefs or ethnic differences and so on. Now, increasingly, it's truth. Even facts are matters of plural opinions. No, I don't agree that the world is round. I have my own view that it's not. And I'll give a fine example of this. A recent poll found that 45% of viewers of Fox News shared three fundamental misconceptions about Iraq, including that we had found weapons of mass destruction. I mean, thunderously wrong notions like that. By the way, NPR listeners, only 4% of them share these three misconceptions. So
we're doing our best, but still it's not a perfect world, Jack.
Right. But here's this different epistemology, you see. Mm-hmm. For Fox viewers, for people who read the Weekly Standard, for people who swear by the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, there are these facts. For Nation readers and for Dean supporters and for others, there are these other ones. But the notion that there is a real world, an objective world, where things are so or not so, has, I think, kind of gone by the board, so that it is very difficult even to talk about honest communication in such a fractured polity.
Well, there's a picture. Michael Sandel, Jack Beattie saying, not only do the people not rule, has deliberation not been reestablished, not held up high, not made a civic role, but truth itself has become amorphous here. Are we backsliding even from 1996?
Well, the biggest test of the capacity of a people to deliberate about common purposes is the debate about whether to go to war. And we saw in the debate about whether to undertake the Iraq War, and it was a long debate in the sense that we had plenty of time to argue about it. But the content of the debate was impoverished, and it was impoverished partly because there was a misunderstanding of certain important facts. A great many Americans believed, according to polls, that Saddam Hussein was involved in the September 11th.
A misunderstanding or a misrepresentation, however ambiguously, or both?
Well, fair enough. But the result, there was a very strange debate about the war, because the main argument for the war was that there was an imminent threat because of weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
When the real reason and the more plausible, more powerful reason for the war was, agree or disagree, that here is an opportunity to try to remake the Middle East and bring democracy to the Middle East. Agree or disagree with that, that should have been the argument. Should we do it? Can we do it?
Was that a new level of dishonesty, or was that a typical level of statecraft where, you know, goals are cloaked in what's politically acceptable and palatable?
I think it was an attempt to cloak a bigger goal in terms that would be more palatable. But I think it was a misjudgment, because I think the stronger, more far-reaching reason whether you ultimately agree or disagree, was the more plausible.
And we should have debated it. We're talking tonight about the health of the American democracy on the eve of a big election year. Our guest is Michael Sandel. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On the eve of a big, big election year, we're talking tonight with political philosopher Michael Sandel about the health and discontents of American democracy. You can join our conversation tonight. What's your diagnosis of the health of the American democracy? Do you have issues, hopes, fears that are bigger than any single candidate? Is democracy just about voting, or is that a shrunken ideal? How are we doing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael's calling from Methuen, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Thank you. Mr. Beatty already made part of my point that I think there's a lack of civic disengagement because people feel like it doesn't do any good.
Or a lack of civic engagement, right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The recent energy and Medicare bills, the Republican tax cuts, demonstrate that government seems to exist to serve the rich and the large corporations. Prior to the Iraqi war, hundreds of thousands of people turned out to demonstrate, and it got buried on page 17 of the newspaper, which didn't even discuss the issues in detail, and it didn't do any good. And we're not even sure that our vote counts. I mean, in Florida, tens of thousands of people, you know, didn't have their votes counted, or maybe even didn't get to vote.
So are you feeling disempowered? Are you feeling like the campaign season isn't really inviting you, or any other season inviting you to put an oar in?
Well, I mean, I consider myself fairly politically active, and I write letters to the editor. I've been on some of these demonstrations, and sometimes I feel like it's all futile.
Michael Sandel, pick it up. Here's an American citizen. Sounds like a voter. It feels futile. That's not the way you want people to feel in a thriving democracy.
Well, I sympathize with what Michael says. The energy bill and the Medicare bills were cobbled together with very heavy lobbyist influence, and there's no denying the sense of disempowerment that flows from that. If I could just add another dimension of the disempowerment that's right before our eyes, but difficult really to make sense of, and that has to do with something you were discussing in the earlier segment, Tom, about the terror alert, the orange, the red, and so on. There is something, and it came through in the comments, people's reactions, frustrations to that. What do we do about it? Mm-hmm. We're told it inspires a kind of fear, and yet we're told, but don't live your lives any differently. Now, if the major threat to the nation now, it's not a nuclear attack from the Soviet Union as it was a generation ago, but it's a kind of invisible terrorist possibility that's measured by the color-coded alerts. And yet, citizens are not being asked really to change the behavior as a result of these alerts that dominate the news. There is something terribly disempowering about that feature.
All right, okay, so here's a great case in point then. Let's turn back to public philosophy. What public philosophy is suggested by that lack of a real call to engagement, and what alternate public philosophy might open a way for Americans to be involved with this consuming issue?
Well, here, what you've asked really is how could we debate in a more meaningful way the whole question of how to confront the terrorist threat. And that's the debate that was missing in the run-up to the war, because there are two very different positions that are out there and that aren't really articulated. One position says the way we fight terrorism is to try to remake the politics of the Middle East, to bring democracy there, to put dictators and terrorists on the run. And that's the position of the Bush administration. And it's not crazy. It's very ambitious. It may not work. It may not have justified the war. It's not crazy.
It's the philosophy of a New York Times columnist and your teaching partner for several years, Tom Friedman, articulated at some length in recent columns.
Right. It's a very ambitious picture that says the war on terrorism is really much bigger than just tracking down al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden.
And the other view?
And the other view says that the war in Iraq and the huge resources devoted there are a distraction from the real, the actual, the literal war on terrorism, which should be shoring up the containers, figuring out how to protect the ports, how to catch bin Laden, how to dismantle al-Qaeda specifically. And there could be a real debate between those two fundamentally different answers. How should we deal with the terrorist threat?
And maybe even a third line of debate about how the American economy and American politics, domestic and global, factor into provoking some of this threat in the first place.
Well, that's, I wouldn't say
at least worth a debate, I would think.
It is worth a debate. It's certainly worth asking, what are the implications of America's role in the world for the frustrations that are experienced by those who are left out of modernity and the benefits of globalization? I wouldn't myself say that those frustrations create the terrorism, because there are a great many people who are frustrated and angry and resentful of American power in the developing world who haven't produced terrorism. But still, that is a question that America, in its engagement with the world, is really a kind now of imperial power, though we don't like to use that word. We have to ask ourselves that question.
So if this critical debate isn't taking place, I want to go back to the really fundamental thing. What is it about the public philosophy operative in the United States today that is cutting, you know, the body politic off from that debate? Why isn't it happening? What's the structural reason in the way we're conceiving or executing on democracy?
Well, one part of the structural reason is the one that both Michael, the caller, and Jack raised, having to do with the role of money and the power of interest in politics. But I don't think that's the only explanation. Another part of it is that, maybe partly because of those structural constraints, the two parties are not really designed to frame questions of the big kind that we've just been addressing. They're all struggling for a relatively small band of voters in the middle, suburban voters who are more or less in the middle of the ideological spectrum. And what we haven't seen is a genuine attempt to renovate the whole political agenda itself, the kinds of questions that we ask. We're still conducting our political debates according to the terms, the outmoded terms of really the old kind of New Deal debate, which is what's the role of government in the economy? What should be the role? And Democrats have one answer, Republicans have another.
And the deeper, more important debate then? The deeper, more important terms?
What are the necessary conditions for meaningful self-government? How can we create opportunities for meaningful citizenship where people really have a say in shaping the forces that govern their lives?
So you're saying it's not just the economy, stupid, in a sense, Michael Sandel.
It's not just the economy, although the economy matters to the way we shape the economy should be looked at and debated not just from the standpoint of who gets what and how much, but also from the standpoint of what economic arrangements and institutions and structures will be hospitable to the capacity for self-rule.
A debate that this country has had in the past but is not necessarily in the midst of right now. We've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Andrew's calling from Kent, Ohio. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi there. I find Professor Sandel's vision of a grand democratic community with effective citizens very appealing, but it also sounds a bit nostalgic, and I'm wondering if it's nostalgic for a time that's never really existed. We've always had divisions based on race and ethnicity and gender and sexual orientation and exclusions based on those things. And I think our best political moments have been not when people reached out for a grand community, but when they said, I'm going to fight for justice for me and for the people like me. And I wonder whether we wouldn't do better to put aside these great questions about public philosophy and say, how can we do better by the people who are being hurt by our current political realities?
Andrew, it's a great question and a great way of posing it, and thanks for calling it in. Michael Sandel, what about this notion? Michael Sandel, you're being nostalgic here for a time, a quality of democracy that never was. And then Andrew says, hey, let's not worry about one big happy family. Let's all dive in to pursue our interests, and that will produce the kind of clash of interests that will be sorted out. That's democracy.
Well, I think I share Andrew's goal, but I don't think that an interest-based kind of group interest-based approach to democracy or to justice will actually produce the kind of justice that Andrew has in mind. Part of the problem is that those who are at the bottom of the social and economic spectrum vote least, which is one of the reasons why the political agenda responds least to their interests. As for the nostalgia, there was an earlier day, and maybe it's very difficult to revive, when, well, go back to when Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt were arguing about the role of the corporation mm-hmm. in American life. And should TR said, no, we need to strengthen the national government in order to rein in big business. And Woodrow Wilson was saying, no, we need to try to break up big business so we have a decentralized economy that doesn't concentrate unaccountable power. That's an example of a debate about the economy, big structures in the economy, in that case, big corporations and monopolies and trusts, that had as its purpose a certain vision of what you need to have an effective democracy.
And why was Teddy Roosevelt arguing against the power of big business? What public philosophy was he operating from when he made that argument?
Well, they both thought that too much power in corporations and in business would suffocate democracy because it would take the most important decisions out of the hands of elected officials and of the people and put them in the hands of big business and of the corporations. And in some ways, the protest against globalization we began to see in the 1990s mm-hmm. raised that question not at the level of national corporations, but at the level of multinational and global corporations and the question of corporate responsibility.
And corporate power. Jack Beatty, it does seem a long time since the corporate role has really been debated. I don't know what Teddy Roosevelt would think about the presumptions that are very clear today. But what about this idea that imagining or wishing for a better quality of democracy is an exercise in nostalgia, that it never was, that this is the way it is, and let's dive in and deal with it?
Well, it's an understandable feeling. I mean, there's such a thing as informed alienation, and I think we could hear that in that caller's voice. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to maintain a faith in the norm of democracy over against its practice. And partly it does take, just what Michael displayed, a recall, a look back at the past when men and women did debate issues not just about who gets what, but about, as he says, the structures of power and influence that could sustain or undermine democracy. We're so famished in our discussion of power in this country today that even to begin to talk about these things is we have to almost invent a new vocabulary. You know, when the populist revolt happened, and that still is the greatest mass movement in American history, millions of people mobilizing.
You're talking about William Jennings Bryan. And
well, not really. The movement that he sort of co-opted that was behind him. That movement had to have its own counterculture. They had lecturers by the thousands who went across the South and propounded the populist take on the world. They had booklets. They had a counter language. They had symbols that would allow them to break off from the monoculture and raise against it other values that simply can't be expressed in it. Well, we're in a situation of even more total dominance by the monoculture. And we almost have to invent that new language, a la the populists, in order even to see our dilemmas now. They had to, as I say, do it through organizing and saying, don't read that, read this. Well, we're almost in that position today, it seems to me, where we need that new language to talk in these fundamental terms about power and democracy.
A new language or a revival of the full spectrum of the language we've got. Patrick is calling from Duxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Good evening.
The point I wanted to make was I think this point about alienation is a bit too much, and it can be a bit disingenuous.
In what sense, Patrick?
Well, I voted for George Bush.
Okay.
I supported the war. It was a close election. There were going to be disputes and credibility questions on the election either way. I always felt the election was about broader things than you know, just the topic of weapons of mass destruction.
The election or the war, Patrick?
I'm sorry, the war. Sorry
yes,
about that.
Got it.
And I think that it almost has a sound to it like, I don't like the current result or the specific result, so therefore democracy is not working.
Ooh, that's interesting.
But if Bill Clinton was in office and other things were happening, I think democracy is working fine.
Well, let me put it to you then, Patrick. Your guy is in office. You won the war, and the country got the war. Do you feel, really deep down, honestly, that democracy is working just fine? Thank you.
I think democracy is working fine, and I think it's working the way it should work. I think it's under certain strains because of the war. You know, the Patriot Act, things like that. I think that will reverse itself when we're in a more secure environment. I think wars bring those kind of things, whether we like it or not. I think we do need to remember, you know, what the country stands for and what we're here for. But I believe that democracy is fine and working exactly the way it's supposed to.
Michael Sandel, you hear the perspective here. Patrick says, hey, you guys are just griping because the issues are not going the way you'd like. And so you roll out a critique of the whole political system as if it's ill.
Well, I think it's a fair challenge, although I would have raised and did raise the same worries during the time when Bill Clinton was in office.
Very loudly, and that's true.
And the problem then was that, well, the debates were impoverished in a different way, I think having to do with an unwillingness really to question the impact and the meaning of globalization and the flow of power away from accountable national governments to the power of corporations that operated globally.
That's a critique you'd make right across Democratic or Republican administrations recently.
Yes, and so the worries that I have are not directed particularly to either the Democratic or Republican Party as such. It has to do with the way we define the questions that those two parties disagree about.
The questions themselves. But Patrick's saying, look, you know, we had an election. It was close. But you know, someone came out a winner. We went to war. He supported it. The democracy feels all right to him. He's not acutely feeling this impoverishment of the vocabulary. Does that mean somebody else is too picky? Could it mean that we just have forgotten what the richness of the debate could be? How do you see it just in practical day-to-day terms when you look out, Michael Sandel?
Well, in practical day-to-day terms, there is the fact that most people don't vote in most elections. A minority of people turn out to vote, even in presidential elections.
So fundamentally not a good democratic indicator by anybody's
50%,
measure.
Right. And then if you actually look at the content of the debate, what is, I would put to Patrick what the question, really, what is the debate shaping up now? What will the debate be between President Bush and his Democratic challenger? Will it be about prescription drug benefits? Will it be about the details of an energy bill? Will it be about privatizing Medicare? Or will it be about bigger questions that people really care about and can have a say in deciding?
That may need addressing. We're talking tonight with Harvard Professor of Government Michael Sandel, political philosopher. We're putting a stethoscope to the heart of American democracy. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On the eve of a big election year, we're talking tonight with political philosopher Michael Sandel about the health and discontents of American democracy. You can join the conversation tonight. What are the biggest pressing issues about the state of American democracy that you'd like to hear George Bush, Howard Dean, Al Sharpton address? And do you feel disenfranchised by big government, big business, big globalization, big media? Where do you and your neighborhood fit in? What's your diagnosis of the health of American democracy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve's calling from Rockland, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I wonder if I could bring the conversation right down to the neighborhood.
Sure.
I'm on a school board here in Massachusetts, local
okay.
school board,
yep.
A very perfectly normal town, not decidedly partisan one way or the other. And let me just make two observations about what I think is broken. And I indeed do think that democracy, even in our little town, is broken.
Wow.
And get the get Mr. Sandel's, Professor Sandel's response to it.
Yeah,
one
please.
Is, I think the capability, the competence, or even the talent of the political leadership is very, very weak. And I can extrapolate from this microcosm of this little town all the way up to the national level. And in particular, the politicians seem to have lost the ability to, if you will, mediate the public's deliberation and interest in, and even just simple ability to stay informed about issues. There's that mediation role of politicians.
Steve, flesh that out a little bit for us so we understand. Why do you think that competence is low? Why shouldn't politicians be good politicians?
Well, I'm not certain this is an answer to your question, but I'll just quick tie in the second point I wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
That so much of the political dialogue, even in our little town, is basically and only framed in terms of taxes in a certain respect. That we you know, the political leadership has totally, it seems to me, lost the idea of public goods, sort of the economic concept of
mm-hmm.
public goods,
mm-hmm.
and created a way of, you know, quite apart from the abstractions of economics, of talking to people, of engaging the community in a dialogue about the creation of public goods.
And you're saying that degrades the conversation. It's all an economic exchange. It's about all about taxes, and the rest is seen as irrelevant.
It's been boiled down to a conversation about whether your taxes are higher or lower, and almost nothing else is allowed to penetrate that not just litmus test, but that sort of test, I guess, if you will.
Steve, let us pick those up, and we're glad you're out there doing your part on the school board. We're sorry that it doesn't look better from your vantage. Michael Sandel.
Well, I think Steve has put it very, very powerfully and eloquently, especially his second point about the lack of an attention to the public good. The focus on taxes, the preoccupation with taxes as the only or the primary political question that Steve talks about, is a symptom, it seems to me, of a politics of individual self-interest completely or largely crowding out a politics of deliberation about the common good. And we saw this, we see this in at the presidential level as well as Steve finds it at the school board level when we have presidential candidates say, go to my website, put in your income data, and you will see, you will calculate how you will be better off in your taxes if I'm elected rather than my
opponent. So it's reduced to a number.
Yes, politics becomes politics is cast as economics by other means. And what's missing is not only deliberation about the common good, but any suggestion that to be a citizen is not only to seek after one's interest in politics, but to contribute to that there are certain civic duties, civic obligations. Here, this brings to mind, Tom, one concrete example mm-hmm. of a kind you were asking me for before. Mm-hmm. What would another public philosophy look like? You remember not long ago in the run-up to the war with Iraq, Charles Rangel in the House proposed a form of a national service or conscription
yes.
for the military.
Mm-hmm.
And this was kind of swept up in the whole debate about Iraq. But
in a provocative idea meant to point out, hey, this could go to a bad end.
Yes. But there was a serious point in that that really would potentially, if developed, provide mm-hmm. another strand to our political debate. And that is a debate about what are the obligations of citizens, not only what are our rights and what are our interests and how will your taxes be reduced mm-hmm. by this or that policy, mm-hmm. but what are the obligations of citizens and do they include serving one's country?
If they're going to be feet on the ground, let's all get our feet on the ground one way or another.
Whether militarily or also conceivably in other forms of national service.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't really had a debate about the general question of citizen obligation and specifically the question, as Rangel's proposal might have invited, should there be some kind of conscription or national service, military or otherwise?
But then related to that, I don't want to let Steve's first point go. He's sitting on the school board and he says he sees a kind of incompetence of political conversation of politicians themselves. Now, why would that be? I mean, Americans, you know, they're at that level, they're still literate, they're reading, they're paying attention to the world, and presumably at the level of political leadership, are American leaders and potential leaders simply not schooled in political philosophy sufficiently? Are they somehow overmatched by circumstances where their rhetorical or conceptual skills could stand up to the environment around them and say, no, let's steer a notch this way or a notch that way different. You know, why should politicians appear overmatched by these circumstances? Why not stand up and lead?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a question that has always been asked of politicians in democratic life. So here I have to be careful not to lapse into nostalgia. On the other hand, I think that what Steve is finding is explained by a general public culture that invites politicians to cater or pander to individual self-interest and to polls that measure that individual self-interest. And to lead really is to offer a picture of the public good that mm-hmm. invites people to look beyond their individual self-interest. And that kind of leadership takes courage. It takes moral and political imagination. It's always been in relatively short supply. The Times sometimes call it forth, sometimes do more than others. But I think that he's identified a dynamic in our public life that is a genuine challenge.
And was there really a time in American history when self-interest was not the first measure of national life, of personal life? I mean, our caller said earlier, that's nostalgic to imagine that. You referred right. to Woodrow Wilson and Teddy Roosevelt, but of course they're great kind of, you know, almost mythic figures. But at the level of the citizenry, was there right. a time when there was a different conception of what participation in this democracy meant?
Self-interest has always been an ingredient of politics and of democratic politics.
To a markedly
in
different
States.
Degree, that ingredient or not?
I think to different degrees. And there are different moments in American political history when that individualistic, self-interested strain has met its match in greater measure by larger public concerns. And admittedly, oftentimes those moments have been times of war or
crisis.
National crisis.
So cite some. What are we talking about? Civil War, World War II? I don't know. What would you point to as times that were different? And is it fair to compare those with now, with the war we've got now, which, as you say, is not, at least at this point, an all-consuming war? It's a war, but it's out there. We don't have everybody being drafted and participating.
Well, it is interesting that war tends to call forth great political leadership and a departure, even though it's often temporary, from a politics of self-interest and instead to call forth a politics of the public good. But also solidarity is much easier to summon during times of national crisis and war. It's much more difficult during times of peace and prosperity. But we're now at war. We are now in a time of war. And one of the remarkable things about this war, if you put it alongside earlier wars in American history, is that it hasn't really been attended by any great calling forth either of civic sacrifice or public purpose.
Jack Beatty, is the polity stepping up to the crisis this time?
Well, it hasn't been asked to, as Michael said. I mean, the president's said, go out and buy. That's what we need to do. And there was a moment there when it seemed to me that he had a kind of forge for a new sort of civic seriousness in America. But partly, I think, and I'm not being critical, I think just descriptive, for ideological reasons, that is, a distrust of government and a partiality toward the libertarian view that we are, you know, we're really basically self-interested individuals who make up a kind of series of atoms who make up a society. I think that was alien. The idea of sacrifice, a common purpose, that was alien to the president's ideology. But, you know, Tocqueville thought our genius here was self-interest rightly understood. That's how he put it. That Americans understand that they have to have their self-interest, but he said, at the last, Americans catch themselves and they say, no, in order to preserve my long-term self-interest, I have to sacrifice to the common good now. I have to keep these public goods in being that I might flourish in them over the long term. And he felt that was the big difference between America and Europe, where people were just selfish to the last degree. And I really think that that's been a lack in American politics, self-interest rightly understood. We don't get there. we just get to self-interest period, and thus Steve has, you know, taxes. How much is it going to cost me? Rather than self-interest rightly understood, if I pay my taxes and if these are good schools, what will that do for the citizenry? What will it do for my sense of living in a good town, et cetera, et cetera?
Which sounds a lot more like Tocqueville's old Europe, which isn't exactly where this project ended out to started out to end up. Judy's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi. I would like to add to the controlling factors, the control of the parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, in terms of the effect on the checks and balances that should exist when we look at issues like the vote on the war and the vote on the Medicare bill and the Clean Air bill and all the rest of the things that have just happened over and over and over again in the last few years.
And how do you see the party structure playing in there, Judy?
Well, what I see is my particular representative getting an overwhelming number of calls to vote against the war and ended up voting for it. And no one's going to run against him within the Democratic Party. And he's, you know, a strong incumbent who will be reelected, and there's no consequence to that vote. And as a matter of fact, shortly after the vote, he got a position on a House subcommittee on terrorism.
So if you're right that his constituency was really so against it, why won't he be challenged, Judy?
Well, because I don't believe that, because he's sort of part of the political establishment, if you will. He's been in that position long enough that nobody, I don't see the Democratic Party willing to put up a candidate against him. They would say, this is going to weaken our place and we got to keep our seats in the House and in the Senate. We don't want to be losing any, you know, to a Republican, and we'll invite challenge.
Right. So you're saying don't make it too high concept, but let's look right down at party organization and whether there's something there that's retarding a more active debate. Judy, our time is short. I want to get that to Michael Sandel. Michael, what do you think?
Well, I think that the two-party system, both parties have lost energy and imagination and essentially have become fundraising machines. There's a great power to incumbency. And a lot of that has to do with the ability to raise funds and with something as simple as name recognition, but also fundraising capacity. And historically, when political parties have ceased to address the questions that really matter to people, there has been a realignment of the party system. Parties have died out over time. And this party system has been entrenched in a way, even, I think, as the agenda that shaped it and gave it meaning, going back to the New Deal and up through the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson, has become obsolete. So we have a party system, I think, that's lost its energy and meaning and instead really has become an instrument for fundraising.
Michael Sandel, our time is so short. We've got half a minute left, but give us just a couple of bywords here. If we want to steer toward the healthiest democracy we can accomplish, what do we look toward? What do we look for?
Well, I would maybe begin by asking the question how we can reshape the political world and the economic world to make it more hospitable to self-government, to invite citizens to think of themselves in relation to public life, not as individuals seeking after their interests, but as participants in a common life, whose destiny can be debated and argued about by citizens who can, in moments at least, make a difference.
Words to carry as we head into a big presidential year. Michael Sandel, professor of government at Harvard, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, great to have you on. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, and thank you, Michael.
Take care, Jack.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is